This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Over 3,000 babies died before their first birthday in Indiana between 2013 and 2017. Indiana's infant mortality rate in 2017 was 7.3, meaning that for every 1,000 babies born in the state, about 7 died before the end of their first year. The national average was 5.8. Since then, legislation has been passed that is designed to address these rates. And Governor Eric Holcomb has set a goal to significantly improve those rates by 2024. But to see that change may indeed take time. Joining us now to discuss the infant mortality rates in Indiana is obstetrician, gynecologist, and the women's product line physician lead for Community Health Network, Dr. Indy Lane. Dr. Lane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Lane, when we look at these statistics around babies not making it to their first birthday, my biggest question is, why? Why is the infant mortality rate higher in Indiana than surrounding states? Can you help us understand some of the reasons?
You know, there are multiple reasons why, and unfortunately there isn't, you know, one answer to the problem. But in general, we know that the infant mortality rate amongst white babies is thankfully going down. And sadly, however, the infant mortality in our communities of color, it's going up in some areas 2 to 3 times that of white infants. And so if you look just in Indiana at the white infant mortality, we would be at our goal or below our goal if we only looked at white babies. However, when you look at communities of color, those babies are dying at a much higher rate. And so, you know, we know that in communities of color, obesity and diabetes and hypertension and rising substance use is playing a role in the infant mortality that we have. We know that Black women don't seek prenatal care or are not receiving prenatal care as soon as their white counterparts. So 55% of Black women are getting prenatal care in the first trimester compared to 71% of white women. You know, and that's a critical time for women. If you present early for prenatal care, then the healthcare provider, be that a doctor or a midwife, can identify what elements of your medical history pose greater risk for preterm delivery and get you treated right away with things, you know, as simple as a progesterone injection, or if you have a history of preeclampsia, a baby aspirin. So those sorts of things are critical early in pregnancy to help prevent preterm delivery.
Among the causes for infant mortality, data from the state suggests that 47% of infant deaths are on account of perinatal risks. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. And so perinatal risks are largely deliveries associated with preterm birth. So growth restriction, meaning that babies are born a lot smaller than they should be based on how far along their pregnancy is, or they deliver early than they should. So they deliver preterm, and as a result, they have a very low birth weight and they cannot survive. Substance use in pregnancy will cause women to deliver early. So all of those factors probably contribute the most to the overall infant mortality that we see in both Black and white women.
And we also know that our maternal mortality rates are concerning in Indiana, women dying either in childbirth or within the first year. It's in Indiana, it's 41.4 of every 100,000 live births for white women, and as high as 53.4 for African-American women, according to America's Health Rankings and the Indiana Department of Health. For context, that's 11 times higher than the maternal mortality rate in California. Do these high mortality rates among infants and mothers go hand in hand?
Absolutely. And so just like a woman who has hypertension may deliver her baby early, hypertension is one of the leading causes for maternal mortality. So whether a woman has chronic high blood pressure, meaning it was pre-existing prior to her pregnancy, or if she develops hypertension during her pregnancy, that is one of the reasons why we lose women during or shortly after pregnancy. Another risk factor is bleeding. And we know that excessive blood loss can contribute to death in women. Also, we're seeing, because of an increasing C-section rate, we're seeing more and more women with undergoing repeat C-sections, which increase the risk of the placenta attaching abnormally, and that increases the risk of bleeding. So bleeding and hypertension, those are contributing to the maternal mortality rates that we're seeing, along with blood clots. You're at increased risk for blood clots after or during pregnancy, and that's also a contributing factor, as well as, you know, rising substance use. In Indiana, the opioid crisis is affecting, you know, not only our general population, but our pregnant women as well. And drug overdoses are occurring in pregnancy as well.
And we know that there are ways to help boost mom's health throughout pregnancy to help aid in better health outcomes for the mother and the baby. Can you explain what some of that prenatal care looks like and the impact that it can have?
Right. And again, as I mentioned, I think that those first early visits, you know, getting a really good personal history from the patient, as well as getting a family history, understanding, you know, perhaps what the patient's mother or her sister or her aunt's pregnancy histories have been like, you know, getting an opportunity to talk about diet and exercise, even in pregnancy. While we don't encourage women to lose weight during pregnancy, if they start their pregnancy overweight, we don't necessarily want that patient to gain 35 pounds during her pregnancy. So having those conversations early, talking about ways to control blood pressure, if blood pressure is an issue, you know, warning signs for diabetes and screening women early for diabetes is critical. Understanding if she has a prior history of preterm birth, what we can do to increase surveillance in those women so that we can identify signs of preterm delivery before she delivers early, you know, mitigating the risks of preeclampsia in patients that have a history of preeclampsia or hypertension in a previous pregnancy. So getting in early and, again, developing a relationship with the provider and getting a really good history is critical.
And what about postpartum care? What should moms be looking for or be aware of after birth to monitor their own recovery and health?
Right. We talk a lot about warning signs of postpartum preeclampsia, which is often a headache, blurry vision, elevated blood pressure, sometimes abdominal pain. Those are symptoms that we want to talk to women about. Even if they didn't have high blood pressure in pregnancy, they still are at risk in the postpartum period, the 6 weeks following delivery, for postpartum preeclampsia or eclampsia, which is when a woman develops seizures. We want to be sensitive to signs of depression as well. You know, suicides play a role in maternal mortality as well. And so we want to make sure that women are equipped and they understand if they're, and as well as their family members, if they're behaving in the way that suggestive of postpartum depression. You know, we want to make them mindful. You know, most women recognize when their bleeding is excessive, or and so they call. We want to make them aware if they have shortness of breath, that is not a normal sign in the postpartum period and could be a sign of a blood clot or a cardiovascular condition that's causing the shortness of breath.
As we mentioned before, there are clear disparities between the mortality rates of white women and their babies and black women and their babies. All of these rates are too high. But what obstacles are black moms facing in particular that increase these rates?
You know, we see the same sorts of disparities, you know, unfortunately, from a social standpoint, whether it's, you know, access to housing or the disparities in education, disparities in incarceration. So some of this goes beyond, you know, the healthcare provider. You know, if you have food insecurity or if you are unemployed, those factors are underinsured. Those factors definitely play a role in your ability to seek prenatal care. And, you know, women, unfortunately, they have to prioritize, you know, either staying at work and, you know, earning a living or, you know, taking care of their children sometimes over making it to their doctor's appointment or having an annual exam every year. So we can't, you know, underestimate just, you know, how difficult it is sometimes for, you know, women just to take care of the family that they have.
But there is also data that suggests that black moms face higher mortality rates regardless of their socioeconomic status. How do we explain this?
Right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, there's lots of data to suggest that implicit bias plays a role. And, you know, implicit bias is, we all have an implicit bias, and essentially it's defined as an unconsciously held set of associations about a social group. They're a product of learned associations and social conditioning. So many of us have these feelings about groups of people without really understanding why or really realizing that we're doing it. And so there are studies that suggest that when it comes to women of color, patients of color wait longer for care, they often aren't allowed to or given the opportunity to collaborate with treatment options. They often report that providers have a condescending tone with them. They are offered different treatment options based on the perception of whether or not they can comply with the care. And we know that there's data to suggest that sometimes their concerns aren't met with the same sense of urgency. And so I think that as healthcare providers, you know, of all backgrounds, we have to be sensitive to, again, these biases that we have, you know, unconsciously, and work together to do a better job.
And along those lines, can you talk about the role that trust plays between medical professionals and soon-to-be or new mothers?
You know, trust is huge. You know, I was talking to some colleagues today, and if, you know, a woman has food insecurity, or if she's recently lost her job or is unemployed, or she has substance use disorder, you know, we want to provide an environment where women feel comfortable about being open about these concerns that they have or these barriers to their care so that we can provide the best care for them. And I think that as organizations, you know, Community Health Network, we are trying to increasingly address social determinants of health, trying to have a better understanding where these barriers to care exist so that we can provide the best health care for women that we can. And I think that, you know, along with implicit bias training, you know, we can't understand the cultural backgrounds of all the patients that we see, but we can be sensitive to those differences. We can sit down with the patient. We can be compassionate and empathetic and make sure that we are, you know, taking time to address her concerns in a way that she can understand. I think doctors can often be guilty of speaking in a way, regardless of your educational level, that can be difficult for patients to understand. And if you're already somewhat intimidated by the environment, or perhaps you are ashamed of your social situation, you're less apt to be an advocate for yourself and to ask the appropriate questions. And so we need to provide an environment where patients can do that.
Dr. Indy Lane, OBGYN at Community Health Network, we appreciate your joining us today. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll be talking more about how to ensure mothers are better supported in the state to make sure that they, as well as their babies, remain healthy and happy in that first year and beyond. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana, I want to tell you about our last show. Yesterday, we talked about Crime Junkie, one of the most popular true crime podcasts right now. Adam Wren, who has written about the podcast for Indianapolis Monthly, joined us yesterday to talk about some of the criticisms around the show. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. Today, we're talking about infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana. And as always, we'd love to take your questions and comments on the topic. What kind of experience have you had with maternal care in the state? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and let us know. In the studio, we're joined by Dr. Mary Abernathy, OBGYN and Associate Professor of Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology at Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Abernathy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And joining us via Skype is Kelly Bryan, doula and founder of Mahogany Maternity in South Bend, Indiana. Kelly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kelly, in our last segment, we talked about racial disparities that we see in infant and maternal mortality rates across the state. Eliminating those disparities is a goal that you're passionate about. How can we do that? How can we best address this issue?
I think one of the best ways that we can address this issue is not to blame the disparity on the at-risk community. Because if we're listening to our moms as we're looking at this data, there's a story behind the data. A lot of moms that I serve tend to come to me and state that they feel afraid sometimes of their providers because they feel as though they're not going to be listened to, and yet that provider's help is in their hands. So if we can put the mom at ease and allow her to feel safe, represented, and heard during her care and be a part of that team, that disparity can go down.
We know that women of color, regardless of socioeconomic status, have higher rates of infant and maternal mortality. And stress is a factor that comes up in this conversation. Can you talk about what some of those stresses look like and the toll that they can take on a mom?
Absolutely. So I know that in the area, some of the areas that I work are the absolute highest for infant mortality and maternal mortality in Indiana, 46628, and the areas that I work in, 466-1419, and all the areas in my communities where the infant mortality rate and the maternal mortality rate is the highest are where moms are in food deserts. Moms don't feel as though they're able to access a lot of the things that other moms in other areas have available to them, fresh fruits and vegetables. Transportation can be an issue. But even when moms that are in other areas where there's a socioeconomic difference, those moms still aren't being heard, not just in the birth room, but at different appointments with their care providers. They feel as though they're not being treated as though they're important. And that stress is really difficult because when you see your provider as an authority figure and you're not being listened to, you don't feel safe. And so a lot of times moms feel as though they're best heard at home or with their friends. And sometimes they're Googling information because they don't want to feel ashamed or want to feel like the provider is going to look down on them for having questions. And sometimes those questions just are never heard. So a lot of the pains that women go through, a lot of the stresses that they have, they're never addressed. So when those issues aren't being addressed, then health declines. And we also know that epigenetically, there's an issue where the stress of slavery, the stress of just being a Black woman in society has taken a toll, and it's marked in our DNA and it's passed on to our babies. So our cortisol levels are automatically higher. And so that stress continues to wear down. There's weathering that affects these moms that also affects the babies. And that's a very big part in why our health declines as it does.
Yeah, it seems like infant and maternal mortality is just kind of a really serious side effect of other big problems that we have to deal with. Dr. Abernathy, what's your perspective on the strategies that are most effective to bridge these disparities?
So we have found that if we can get women into prenatal care early, we can start to identify a lot of these stressors as well as health issues. If we can get them into care early, we can, you know, get all of the other social workers and community health workers involved to really help bridge those gaps, whether it's a gap in housing, transportation, food insecurities. We can hopefully help identify those problems and get care for those problems. And then as well, as what Kelly was talking about, is that because of those chronic stressors, many women who are of color have problems with obesity, sometimes goes along with that diabetes, high blood pressure. We know that our Black mothers have a higher risk for preeclampsia and eclampsia, especially in the mortality rates. And so if we can get them into care earlier, we can try to identify those issues and then see if we can help work out some of the solutions.
Kelly, you work as a certified birth and postpartum doula. Can you explain what a doula is for those of us who might not be familiar?
Absolutely. So the word doula is Greek in origin, and it means woman who serves. And what that transfers in the system to is it's a trained professional who provides continuous physical, emotional, and informational support to a mom before, during, and after childbirth to help her achieve her very best and healthiest and most satisfying experience possible during her birth. So that's somebody who's going to meet with you is sometimes as soon as you find out you're pregnant, all the way up until that childbirth and the postpartum period. This is someone who learns about your health habits, learns about your family, learns about your preferences, meets with your provider to say, this is my role, this is what I do, and how can I help you to understand what the provider is asking of you? And, you know, did you have other questions and did you understand the answer? So a doula is somebody who is there basically to bridge any gaps and to make sure there's great communication for her birth team.
Dr. Abernathy, this was my world recently. I have a 4-month-old. So he was born at the beginning of August. We didn't have a doula. And it wasn't that we didn't have a doula on purpose. It was just kind of, we're both busy and it just didn't come to that. What are your thoughts on the value of a doula? Or are other or maybe other people who support the mother through pregnancy outside of her primary physician?
I think that largely it depends on if the woman feels she needs additional support. Some women may have help from their mother or a sister. Not all women have that. And so certainly a doula is there to kind of help guide the patient if they have questions they don't feel comfortable answering. And we see that a lot of in our women of color, as Kelly has been kind of talking about, that sometimes they don't even feel like they can question a physician authority figure. And so we see that that extra support person for women who may need it, who may not have, you know, guidance, navigation, it can be very, very helpful. And so I think it's wonderful. We would like to increase the number of doulas, and I think there's some things that the state has been doing, passing legislation to try to work to improve the number of doulas that are trained that can get reimbursed here in the state.
We hear mostly about doulas helping out before and during birth. And, of course, they can help with care for mothers and babies after the birth as well. Breastfeeding is often something that new moms have questions about. And when we spoke to Dr. Indy Lane in the last segment, she talked about how it can be challenging, to say the least. Kelly, how do you help guide a new mom who wants to breastfeed?
So that's really an excellent question, because it's really important to have that person that's there that understands you. From a doula's perspective, we help with breastfeeding by making sure, number one, that mom is informed about how breastfeeding works in her body, giving her classes on that and helping her to understand how her body works and how baby's body works, understanding that breastfeeding is natural. And if mom has stigmas that are barriers for her with breastfeeding, helping her to walk through that. If she's been the victim of physical abuse or sexual abuse, helping her to deal with those emotions so that she understands that there are ways to make sure that she gets breast milk to her baby, even if she doesn't want to put baby to breast. But then if she's strong enough or she feels like she's ready, then helping her to do that, helping her to position baby, helping her to stay hydrated, making sure that she's eating healthy food and understanding what healthy food is during breastfeeding, and just talking to her through the hardest points, because we know that that third day after baby is born can be one of the most challenging. And if she can get past that first week and continue to have that support, she will have a better outcome with her goals as far as breastfeeding is concerned.
Now, I am very aware of the challenges because, like I said, my wife is currently breastfeeding. But I'll leave it to the experts. Dr. Abernathy, what are some of the common challenges that moms face? Breastfeeding.
Well, babies don't always come out and latch on, especially I had a premature baby and I thought I knew it all. It was very humbling to know that it's kind of like teaching a toddler to dance. Most of us haven't mastered that by any means. But the first thing is, you know, making sure that they're bonding. And sometimes if women may need help with that, especially if they've not had a very good bonding experience with their parents or mothers above. So that's important. Latching on is important. One of the things that my husband dealt with was he said, I don't know how much breast milk she's getting. And he was kind of worried about that. And I was like, frankly, I don't know either. Our pediatrician, who was very good at, gave us some very good advice that I pass on, is, does the baby have wet diapers? If the baby has wet diapers, then you know they're getting plenty of hydration. The other thing is, because then we started, you know, everybody's using Pampers and, you know, the ultra dry, you can never tell. Is it wet or not? So she said, put a cotton ball in the baby's diaper. And if the cotton ball's wet, you know that the baby's making urine. And so it's just those very kind of practical, reassuring tips that like doulas can give. You know, if you don't have a mother that's experienced, you know, the same sort of issues, they can very well help out. Doulas, community health workers, anyone that can give you some good advice. And those are kind of the practical tips that I would shoot for.
What do we know about the health effects of breastfeeding for the baby?
Well, we know, and what I always try to tell our mothers is, even if you can't breastfeed for very long, start to try to do it. That first colostrum, the first few days, the milk, mother doesn't produce a lot of milk. But that milk is very rich in antibodies, and you can continue to get antibodies through the breast milk, even if you go back to work and you can't, you know, continue to pump. Even if you can breastfeed the baby one or two times a day, that's very key and important for the baby to at least get those antibodies. It gets good nourishment. It's very easily digested, and that's why we think you have to breastfeed so much more often is because it's so much more easy for the baby to digest. And so it's very helpful for the baby to have breast milk for the obviously nutritional, but I think from an immunological standpoint as well.
What, though, if a mother chooses not to breastfeed or can't breastfeed?
Then I'd say that's totally fine. What I have seen is that some women who want to breastfeed are so controlled by it, they develop guilt. And once you develop guilt, then things start adding up and compounding, and it can lead into depression, perinatal depression. So I have frequently, especially I take care of a lot of women who have had very early, very premature babies, and their breast milk just doesn't come in like it would if they were at term. And so I always say, stop. You want what's best for your baby. You're doing what's best for your baby. You may not be able to ultimately be Elsie the cow. But even if you can try to breastfeed, that's great. If you can't, don't let that be an overwhelming guilt experience. And I always tell them, there'll be plenty of things later in this child's life that you'll feel guilty over. Don't let this one be a brick wall at this point.
Kelly, you also work to help minimize the risk of postpartum depression among new moms. What are some of the risk factors that you look for?
Well, I look for things like who she's surrounded by. How much care is she getting at home? What's the communication like? I know that a lot of times we have baby showers and everyone's celebrating mom's pregnancy and there's pictures and gender reveals. But then afterwards, everyone goes home and they settle down, or they might come over and visit and take the baby and walk away and celebrate baby and mom's sitting there. So I look for who she's surrounded by during the postpartum period. How often is she going and speaking with somebody, another mom, another person, another human being? How often is she communicating with people and getting her emotions outside of herself? What is her eating looking like? When I speak with her on the phone or when I see her face to face, is she making eye contact? Is she telling me that she's feeling blue? When was the last time she smiled and laughed? And is she getting enough rest? Is she getting enough sleep? I want to make sure that she is taking care of herself, her own heart, and doing that self-care. If I find that she's not doing self-care, but she's doing cleaning or maintenance or worrying all about the baby or her surroundings, she's not taking care of herself. And when she starts to say things like she's having dreams or nightmares, or she's having bad thoughts, or she's just feeling blue or down, or just things don't feel right, then we have those conversations. We have the Edinburgh test that we do to look for certain signs and certain things. And I make sure that she knows ahead of time what postpartum depression can look like, because it can be sneaky, and making sure that her partner knows the signs of postpartum depression. I look to make sure that she wants to take care of herself, and she is really equally as concerned about her own health as she is about baby. Is she making sure that she's going to her 6 weeks checkup? Because a lot of times that can be a very big signal if she's not wanting to talk to the doctor, if she's not wanting to see people to come over to the house. You know, and sometimes we do have too many visitors, and that can be a factor. But when she's just wanting to shut off and be alone, sometimes that can be a key indicator that something has gone wrong.
Dr. Abernathy, what are ways that moms can differentiate between the feelings of normal recovery and adjustment and something like postpartum depression? It can get blurry there, and it's a very hectic and different and strange time for a lot of people. How would a mom be able to recognize those differences?
You know, I don't know that always moms can recognize it. That's part of the problem. And I think that's where you have to start asking her mother or her spouse or her, you know, whoever she has a relationship with. And so I think it's very hard. And you want to kind of pinpoint and say, is she eating? Is she sleeping? You know, will she let you, this is another thing, will she let you take care of the baby for, in order for her to get, you know, some time alone or some downtime or a nap or even a shower? And if you start sensing that they're worried, they're concerned, then that's when you want to kind of start talking to the woman alone in a room and start kind of addressing, how are you doing? How are you feeling? You know, how are you eating? How much sleep do you get? And so, unfortunately, a lot of times women they don't know it and they can't recognize it. You can tell them the warning signs, you know, eating, sleeping, you know, having feelings or thoughts, you know, of hurting yourself or hurting the infant or, you know, harming something. But many times the woman may not recognize it, and that's part of the problem. And so that's when you start to have to look for her surrounding kind of environment and those people that she's around. And that, again, is why doulas and community health workers and nurse family partnership, the nurses that do home visiting, are so important, because she may not have anyone that can support her. And so that's why they're going out into the homes. They're doing a fantastic job, and they can kind of assess it. When you're in the situation, you may not be able to readily identify it.
Kelly, we only have a very, very short amount of time, but what about dads? I know for moms and babies, obviously, this is a big, major medical event, but do doulas provide support for dads as well?
Absolutely. Doulas love to support dads in teaching them what's best to say, what's best not to say, because sometimes during labor, he's really, really in his feelings and emotional and excited, and he may not understand that sometimes patience is a virtue. But dads are important because their affection and their words and their closeness.
That'll have to be it. I'm so sorry. Dr. Mary Abernathy, OBGYN, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kelly Bryan, doula, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk to Indiana State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back now talking about infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana. We've been talking about some of the struggles that mothers face in the state, and joining us now to talk about some of the work that's being done to address those challenges is the Indiana State Health Commissioner, Dr. Christina Box. Dr. Box, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Matt, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, before we jump into infant and maternal care, can you describe what your role is as the Indiana State Health Commissioner?
So as the State Health Commissioner, I am charged with protecting and supporting the health of all Hoosiers across our state. And that is my underlying goal and desire for the state of Indiana. As an OBGYN and a mother of four and a grandmother, my passion is really directed a lot toward infant mortality and maternal mortality here in our state.
And before you were the Indiana State Health Commissioner, you spent 30 years as a practicing OBGYN. How has that experience informed the way you approach this problem that Indiana has surrounding infant maternal mortality?
So in the past, as the Women's Service Line lead for community hospitals here in the Indianapolis area, I really became engaged with addressing substance use disorder with our team in pregnancy and neonatal abstinence syndrome, where a baby basically goes through withdrawal symptoms after it's delivered from a mom who has been using medications like opioids during pregnancy. And in that, became very aware, acutely aware, of our infant and maternal mortality rate here in Indiana, and felt like my mission really needed to be closer to home. So feel very blessed that the governor gave me the opportunity to address this in a bigger fashion than I could have ever imagined.
So you worked with and supported a lot of mothers over your career. What did you find were the most critical components of making sure that mothers and babies were happy and healthy?
So, you know, there are a lot of women that I took care of that had all the resources that they needed. They had careers and jobs, or their husband or spouse was supporting them at home. They had access to insurance. They had access to transportation, access to good hospitals. But there were certainly mothers that I took care of that it was a struggle, you know, whether they were going to be able to put food on the table at night, whether they were going to be able to have a roof over their head and their children's head, whether they would even be able to find transportation or fill the prescription that I gave them. So those were issues, those socioeconomic factors that really can become a barrier to a mom getting into prenatal care early and sustaining that care throughout her pregnancy and then establishing that care for her newborn. And really something that as a clinician in your office, where we deliver about 20% of healthcare versus the other 80% being where a woman lives, works, and plays, those are things that as clinicians we didn't have a lot of access to resources or didn't understand the resources available to help connect those women to.
And the state is working to change the statistics that we know about. 602 babies dying prior to and after birth. This is data from 2017. Just this last legislative session, we saw House Bill 1007 get signed into law, which was centered around perinatal care. Can you expand on exactly what change the bill called for?
Right. So the bill requires the Indiana State Department of Health, in conjunction in working with Family and Social Services Administration, which is where Medicaid lies, and Department of Child Services, because, you know, a child has to live and thrive through that first year of their life, for all of us to work together to develop a perinatal navigator program, which really is an opportunity for us to offer women, starting in our highest risk zip codes and counties here in the state, the opportunity to be matched with wraparound support services, family support services, home visitation services within their own communities to address those things I was just speaking about.
Screening expectant mothers for substance abuse was part of this bill, and one of the hopes was that the earlier you connect a mother to resources, the better the outcome for mom and baby. How critical is the element of time in this equation?
It's absolutely critical. You know, about 44% of our female overdose deaths occur ages 20 to 40. So that is prime childbearing years. And we know from looking at statistics and research that if a woman is ever likely to accept help and get into treatment and then recovery for substance use disorder, they're more likely to do that when they're pregnant or they have a newborn at home. So it's an ideal opportunity for us to recognize these women and to be able to sit one-on-one with them in a safe situation and offer them the opportunity to get in treatment for their substance use disorder. And we know that improves not only their outcomes, but can significantly improve the outcome for their unborn child.
And Indiana's been working on a strategy to make that prenatal care and resources available and accessible to mothers, and it's called the OB Navigation Program. Can you introduce us to this program?
Right. So 1007, that's what I started talking about, was the concept that we would develop this perinatal navigator program so that a navigator would be a community-based healthcare worker of some type. It could be a nurse from Nurse Family Partnership. It could be a paramedic from communities that don't have other opportunities. It could be Healthy Families, which we have in all 92 counties. It could be a community-based healthcare worker that basically partners with that pregnant woman and follows her through the pregnancy and at least that first year of the baby's life thereafter. Just kind of helping to connect that woman to resources to keep her lights turned on, to make sure she has transportation, to reinforce the education that we're giving her about the need to avoid smoking during pregnancy and to get treatment for her substance use disorder and to address a healthier diet, especially if she becomes a diabetic, or to monitor her blood pressure. So it is that extra support within the community that we as clinicians don't have a lot of control over from our offices or our hospitals.
I want to go back to the verbal screening of for substance abuse disorder. Shame is a big factor here. People don't want to admit their problems where this is concerned. How do you get around that? How do you communicate that this is important and we need to know and we're not going to judge and we're not going to go forward with legal action or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that is an excellent point. And first of all, if you think it's difficult to admit that you have issues with substance use disorder as a single individual, imagine admitting that when you're carrying a child. That stigma associated with that is a very difficult thing to come over. And there's been, in the past, a lot of judgment associated with this. And so really the first thing is to mandatorily verbally screen every woman. That way we're not making any judgments about any individual who walks in our office. This is something like every pregnant patient gets tested for HIV unless she refuses it. Every pregnant patient gets tested for syphilis and their blood count and their blood type. Those are just routine things we do on everyone. So this is just an additional thing that American College of OBGYN, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Family Physicians all say we should be doing with our pregnant women. So when it becomes something that we do with everyone, it kind of removes the stigma a little bit. And studies have shown that if you sit one-on-one in a safe space with a woman and explain to them you're asking these questions not so that you can refer them to DCS, not so that you can refer them to law enforcement, but so that you can offer them that opportunity to have a better life and a healthier life, not only for themselves and their baby. The studies show that women are usually very honest with us about that.
Do we see any patterns in the types of barriers moms face to adequate care where this is concerned?
Well, there's, first of all, a big misconception out there amongst a lot of women that are covered by Medicaid. They think that their Medicaid has, their application has to be finished and approved. And in reality, if we do something as simple as Medicaid presumptive eligibility, which can be filed within about, you know, a 10 or 15 minute by sitting down with a provider or a provider's office to do that, they get the result and the approval of that presumptive eligibility very quickly. And that allows us to start treating that patient while the Medicaid application is being completed and Medicaid is determining whether that woman actually is approved for Medicaid. Even if that Medicaid application is not approved, number one, all of the services that she obtained prior to that will still be covered. And number two, we know resources that we have within her community that based on her income level, we can refer her to. So there's a lot of good things that can come from just being able to have this opportunity to work with women. But women see that as a barrier to getting into care. Traditionally, culturally, a lot of women said, hey, my mom didn't get care. I didn't get care with my first pregnancy till I was, you know, 10 or 12 weeks from delivery. And they don't always understand the impact that that first, you know, 12 to 20 weeks can have on the development of a baby and the risk factors that they face later in pregnancy. So getting their blood pressure under control and getting their smoking stopped or cut down as much as possible, treating their substance use disorder, those, that impact is huge, especially in that first part of pregnancy, to set the tone for the later part of pregnancy.
I always think about moms in rural areas and that being a barrier as well. They're often having to travel to different counties to get the care that they need. Why is it that some of these rural hospitals don't necessarily have the ability to offer this kind of care?
So we do have 33 counties that either don't have a hospital or the hospital does not have obstetrical services. And that is a barrier to women getting care closer to home. So as a part of OB Navigator, what we're doing is working to get these type of family support services, this home visitation service, making sure that our counties do have that availability so we can connect women to care. Our goal as a part of OB Navigator is to work with communities like Vigo County and Tippecanoe County and other counties across the state that do have obstetrical care but are kind of surrounded by counties that do not, to potentially hire an advanced practice nurse or a midwife that can actually go closer to home and deliver OB care, maybe in a family doctor's office that's too busy to do obstetrics, or the local health department, or even a clinic within the hospital system. So understanding the need to be able to connect women to care there. Another really important part of this is the levels of care that was voted through in legislation in 2018. The governor supported that as part of his agenda, along with our OB Navigator program. And what that really does is help to establish a level of care for both maternal care and for infant care that we know that women and babies with risk factors would then be delivered at a hospital system that has the facilities, the employees, the equipment that is needed to be able to address those risk factors. And as a part of that, making sure that in these counties that we don't have that obstetrical care available, or in counties where there is a less acute care available, like our level one and two hospitals, that we have a good transportation network system outlined and the safest way to transfer that mother-baby unit or that baby after it's born. So that's been a big part of levels of care, and we are just now starting in September certifying all of our hospitals for their level of maternal and infant care.
Now, I have a four-month-old at home, and I also have a two-year-old, so I've been through it once before, but you kind of have to be reminded of certain things. Education.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Education is such a big thing, and they tell you all kinds of important things at the hospital. But I can imagine that if someone who doesn't really have access to care doesn't know these
right.
things, then it could be really bad. I mean, just simply getting the right information on the right at the right time can make a big difference. What do parents need to know about things like safe sleep?
Right. Really, really good question. And so even those of us who have gotten prenatal care during the whole pregnancy and someone's talked to us about breastfeeding and how that decreases the risk for infection and protects the baby, at least in that first year of life, things like safe sleep, that the only safe way for a baby to sleep is alone on their back in their own crib, that co-sleeping with a baby, you know, an adult with another or another child with a baby, or sleeping on a couch with cushions, or, you know, those beautiful bumper pads that we see in those beautiful beds, you know, and all the blankets, that's not safe sleep. So even those of us that have that education during our pregnancy and it's reinforced at delivery time, at delivery you're overwhelmed and you're tired and you're not getting sleep and we give you so much information. That concept of having that OB visitor that actually sees you in the home, that home visitation service, to follow up and reinforce the safe sleep, to look at the crib and say, hey, I'm glad you've got your crib, but realistically, those blankets that are in there or all those cute stuffed animals don't belong in the crib because that wouldn't be safe sleep. That could suffocate a child. Or, you know, how's the breastfeeding going? And, you know, a woman's milk doesn't come in until 3 to 5 days, oftentimes after her delivery, and oftentimes they've gone home by that point. So to be able to have that touch with a lactation consultant or someone who understands lactation and can be that support person is really, really helpful.
And we also know from the data that there are big racial disparities when we look at the Indiana infant mortality rates. The state's black infant mortality rate is 15.3 per 1,000 babies born, while the white rate is 5.9 and the Hispanic rate is 7.6. How can we address these disparities?
Right. And that's a big issue, not just in Indiana, but across the United States. I mean, as you say, our black infant mortality rate is over 2.5 times our white infant mortality rate. And so a big part of what we're trying to do is with our OB Navigator program is to make sure that individuals that are providing home visitation, individuals that are providing family support services as much as possible come from the communities that they serve, because they're automatically trusted within those communities. They relate with those communities and can really help to establish that trust factor. And then making sure that as we do media campaigns, as we do programming and we deploy resources, that we're engaging the communities that we're really trying to hope that we're reaching. So, you know, making sure that media campaigns resonate with our African American population and our Hispanic population. I mean, it is good news. We've seen for the first time in 3 years our infant mortality rate overall go down from 7.5 to 7.3. But at the same time, our black infant mortality rate went up. So we've got a lot of work to do, but the programs that we are instituting at this time based on recent legislation in the last 2 years, I really do feel are directed toward addressing those disparities.
So we've talked a lot about OB Navigator. Are there other resources that exist in the state for moms and babies that people might not know about or you maybe think are underused?
Well, our Moms Helpline is basically a great resource. So women can call and get resources with them in their own community and to be connected with that. And that number is, if it's okay if I give it, 1-800-844-MOMS, M-O-M-S. So 1-800-844-MOMS, M-O-M-S.
All right, here comes the big question. What is your outlook on maternal and infant mortality rates in the state? Do you feel hopeful about changing these trends in a meaningful way?
I absolutely do. I think the state of Indiana has come together, and we're seeing communities come together all over the state to work with the programming that our legislators and the governor have supported, not only financially, but with legislation. And I feel like we have put so many programs in place that we're covering all these fronts, and I believe we're truly going to bring down our infant mortality rate and our maternal mortality rate in the state.
Again, the Moms Helpline number is 1-844-624-MOMS, 1-844-624-6667. Dr. Box, thank you for being with us today and sharing these resources. We appreciate your time.
Matt, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. And tomorrow we'll preview the 2020 legislative session with our State House reporter Brandon Smith and his counterpart at the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, Nikki Kelly. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.